The first question. Acharya Prabhupada, I forgot what PhD really stands for. Your version, you know, that's only a joke. Permanent, that's a P. Head, that's a H. D, damage. Permanent damage. That's what somebody once said. Of course, it's not like that. You have to work really hard for your PhD. But that's what somebody with a PhD said. He told me. Permanent head damage. Could you share with us when you decided that your path was to be a monk? How did you know? What did it feel like? When I came out of my mother's womb, apparently I had a bald head. That was an omen. It was a sign. I was to become a monk. The next thing was when I first saw my first monk. Wow, that's amazing. I saw a Buddhist monk at the university, the Cambridge Buddhist Society. Wow, a real monk. So that was also the second sign. And then when I did become a monk, I thought I'd only become a monk for a short time. That's why I went to Thailand, because you don't have to become a monk forever. You can decide to disrobe any time. I could disrobe right now in front of you. All I need to say is I disrobe. Oops. And they actually got to mean it, though. And this is, you know, many of you know this story. When I was first ordained as a monk, I was in Thailand, in a monastery in Bangkok. And the first few days, it's absolutely true, I had nightmares. Just after my novice ordination, I woke up in a sweat, the first 4 or 5 nights. And the nightmare was, absolutely honest, my nightmare was I was a layperson. And I opened my eyes, saw my robes next to my bed. I'm a monk, I'm really a monk. And I closed my eyes and went to sleep, a nice quiet sleep. There's some psychology in there that I really, really wanted to become a monk. That's why I had nightmares and I wasn't a monk for the first 4 or 5 nights. And then they just disappeared. As it got into my subconscious, I really was a monk. So that was me. I was a born monk. Would you recommend earplugs to retreat people, at least for beginners? Yes, but not during my talks. Earplugs. I can have earplugs, fine, but please keep your ears open especially when I tell my jokes. It's really disappointing when you tell a joke. You put so much effort into it, and people look at you. So, earplugs for retreating people, at least for beginners. If you want to, yeah. But sometimes they're very disturbing, just the feel of them. Except if you really want to use the earplugs, the best thing to do is to go to these audiologists. These are experts, and I got these earplugs for when I go on an aircraft so I can sleep. And they're amazing stuff. They just squirt this like silicon into your ear holes, and they pull them out afterwards, and there's the shape of your ear. And they can, then they mold. Special ones, and not the same on either ear, they're different. And so you put them in, and you don't know they're there. They're actually molded exactly to fit your ear cavity. And they were so good. The first time I tried them on a flight, that I put them in there, and I thought, I can really meditate quietly, because on a flight, there's always, there's always kids who start crying. And if there's 2 kids in there, I don't know why it is, but once one starts, the other one goes as well. And it's so noisy. Well, I'm not used to kids. We don't have kids and babies in monastery, only the big babies. But the ordinary young babies we don't have. And I put these ones in, you know, so I can have some really silence. And so I could meditate. So I put them in, started meditating, and I fell asleep. So they're really good. And after I woke up, went to the toilet, and I remember walking to the toilet and thinking, wow, this aircraft is very quiet. I've got my earplugs in. That's how comfortable they are. So I really recommend those. Get them from an audiologist, and they're specially molded to fit the shape of your ears. If you use the other ones, the foam ones, they're really uncomfortable after a while. So earplugs is great on a retreat. But also for a marriage as well. They're very, very successful keeping the couple together. I promised a friend to ask you how to resolve this conceit issues I keep having. I am uncomfortable when someone gives me something like a gift. I'd be conditioned to duties before rights. I have to do something first before entitled to anything. That's the first one. So, first of all, you have done something. It must be some karma in the past that someone is giving you something. So, think you have done something. You cannot remember. And also, don't be so selfish. You may not need the gift, but that person needed to give it to you. When I heard that, it just totally changed the idea of gifts and generosity. It doesn't matter if I've already got one. Somebody gives it to me because they need to practice generosity. So I accept it. If I don't need it, then I give it to somebody else. That way everybody's happy. I remember just going, I was in Melbourne, and there was this lady, she was the grandmother of was a Sri Lankan cricketer who played for Australia. What was his name again? Came with A, Ashin or something. Sorry? No, he played for, so anyway, you know him anyway. His grandma was in hospital. She had some sort of cancer or something. So I went to go and see her. Sorry? Agar, yeah. Ashton Agar, that's it. Yeah, his grandma was in Melbourne. She was a devout Buddhist. And that's actually how he gets to spin the ball. She's a spinner, apparently, because he does his meditation. And then his power of mind. Go that way. Go that way. Is that cheating, do you think? If you had those psychic powers and you actually used them to win a cricket match, would that be cheating? No. Depends who you're playing for. If you're Sri Lankan, play for Sri Lankan, that's not cheating. Anyway, where are we going? That's okay, yes. Went to go and see her, and she knitted a pair of socks for me. And I don't wear socks. Even when I was in Korea, that was actually earlier this year, February. It was minus 15 degrees centigrade outside. It was thick snows up in the mountains, South Korea. And I went out, we're having this walk, and the TV cameras were there, and I had no socks on. Just the same, exactly the same shoes I wear here, no socks on in minus 15 degrees. Everyone else had big boots on. Me, I just had this robe on. I did have a woolly hat on, but that was the only difference in what I wear here. And all the TV cameras, I just looked up and saw, and they weren't actually watching anybody. They were all pointed at my feet. I have now got the most famous feet in South Korea. Stupid Western monks, they don't need socks because they've got samadhi power, meditation power. But anyway, I don't usually wear socks. But this woman had knitted some especially for me. So what did I do? I said, I don't want your socks. I don't need socks. Of course I would never do that. That would be a terrible thing. She went to all that trouble. So I said, thank you very much. And I put them on. And as I walked out of this only small hospital, I did notice that her room was overlooking the car park. So as I walked out, I lifted my robe. And I kicked up my heels so she could see my socks. And I looked up and of course she was at the window watching, laughing her head off. And that was a beautiful thing to do. When I got back to the temple, I took the socks off and put them in the stores. I washed them first before I put them in the stores. But because I don't wear socks, but at least you accept them. Someone else can make use of that, but just you accept the gift. And it's such a beautiful thing to be part of generosity. So that's why when someone gives you something like a gift, oh, for goodness sake, it's nothing to do with you, it's about them. They need to give you something. It's an expression of love. So don't sort of deny that. It's not for you. It's for the person who gave you the gift. It's hard for me to accept help offered by others. I feel like I'm imposing my responsibilities to them. How do I change my perception? I understand law of karma. You're giving them the opportunity to make good karma by helping you. So all of you who have partners, if you're sick, tell your partner, your wife, your husband, it says in the suttas, that anyone who looks after the sick is like looking after the Buddha. So here I am, wife, look after me. And you're making really good karma looking after me. So pamper me as if you would pamper the Buddha. Does that work? My wife says, no, come on, look after yourself. You've only got a cold. Come on, get up. Go to work. So, but you're missing out your opportunity, good wife. Look after me. It's good karma to look after me. And it goes both ways. And it's wonderful. You know, it really is a lot of happiness if a monk is sick to have the privilege of looking after them. Seeing how you can make them happy. Find out what they really like to eat. And look after them. It's a great joy and a privilege to give to other people. But it's very difficult for me to give anything because I'm too senior. But what I've done, and you've seen me do this, I've rushed to the door to open it for you. I've opened up the gate for you. I get so much happiness doing that. I don't need to. I'm a senior monk. You're not supposed to do that. If I tried that in Sri Lanka, I'd get into big trouble. But I like doing that because it's my way of like giving something for you. And I don't, you know, just when you help me, I don't get embarrassed. It's actually wonderful because it's your job of getting some happiness, giving something to me. And it's wonderful when somebody gives me something and I actually use it. Venerable Chunda knows this. This very old lady, she knitted some fly whisks a few days ago. You know, and they're just out of basically, I don't know, out of wool. And I've been using mine. Not to keep flies away, to keep elephants away. And it's working. Since I used it, no elephant has ever come close to me. So you're just having fun with it. But when I was using it, she was having a big smile on her face, laughing, and she said it was wonderful that I accepted it, even though it's pretty useless, but it's still nice to have. So it's great when you know you can actually give something to somebody and they receive it. So giving, receiving, oh, please never lose an opportunity to give something. If it's a bottle of water, somebody's thirsty, you have some. Or if it's, say, receiving something, someone wants to give it to you, then please accept it. Because otherwise you're destroying a beautiful part of human life, which is expressing your love, your concern, by giving and receiving. So please do both. P.S. The Dodgy Brothers, perhaps the Deva who missed the roulette game, kept putting this bad, dry joke in my head. I have just to get it out of my system. No, when you give someone a joke, it's dana. It's like giving, it's generosity. And we have to receive the joke. So thank you. Here we go. How did Donald finally win the election and become President of the United States? He used his Trump card to vote. I think you were quite right to think that maybe you shouldn't have told that joke. But no, thank you anyway. It was a very good try. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, what is the Pali word for letting go? There are four Pali words for letting go, and I use that. There's the four ways of letting go. And that is Chaga, Pajinissaka, Muti, Analia. That is in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first teaching of the Buddha. The four ways of letting go. So Chaga is, and it fits in here, generosity, giving. Because if we don't know how to give a donation, why? It's because we're just too stingy. We think we need it. If you don't give someone, you know, the last piece of bread, you take it. I don't need it, you know, on the breakfast, or the last bit of rice, or the last banana, whatever you like, give it to somebody else. If you haven't got that liberality, that generosity, you know, if somebody's trying to cut in on the way home, on the freeway, let them in, for goodness sake. That's generosity. So you're on a tram in Melbourne, and then, you know, you're taking a seat, let someone else sit down. It's generosity. It's wonderful when you do stuff like that. And that is, you know, chaga, giving. But it has to be giving, expecting nothing back in return. There have been many, many really generous donors to this retreat center. We didn't get money from the government for this. It's all the many, many donors from all over the place. But there is no record of their donations. You don't see that this hall is Ananda Hall because it was donated by Ananda. You don't see the kitchen as Winnie Kitchen because Winnie was the biggest donor. You don't see anything like that. Which I think is wonderful. All the donations are totally anonymous. You give expecting nothing back in return. And sometimes I've seen big lists of names of who gave what. That is not generosity. That is buying advertising rights for your ego. So people can actually see what you've given. So that is not generosity. Generosity is invisible. You're actually giving, just for the sake of giving. If it's actually giving so your name's put on the hall, then that is, again, that's business. It's buying advertising rights. So that's the first one, chaga, is just giving. The next one is patinisaga, which is just basically throwing stuff away. Boom! Which is why Ajahn Chah would say this, for all of you who are still holding on to the past, worrying about the future, you don't know how to let go. He would pick up a stick. He did this to me. I remember exactly where he did this to me. He did it to many monks. He picked up a stick and he said, Brahma Wang, so how heavy is this stick? And before I could answer, he'd thrown it away. So don't leave it. That's okay. Leave it. Let go. Let go. Because as soon as he threw it away, he said, it's not light now. So it's not heavy anymore. It's only heavy when you hold it. When you throw it away, it's not heavy anymore. So all your problems and concerns, it's only heavy when you hold it. So throw it away. So anyone who has any problems, they still haven't been able to let go of it yet. There's two ways of dealing with this, and I've told this to a couple of people on their interviews. The old way was they would write it on a piece of paper, tie it to a stick, and throw it in the forest somewhere, just like it's only heavy when you're holding it. But that created too much litter in the forest, so we tried the other way of letting go, throwing things away, which is writing down all your problems, the stuff which you find difficult to let go of, who said what to whom, and what you did, and what you're worried about in the future. Write it down on a piece of paper, and you all know the type of paper you're supposed to write it down on. On toilet paper. We have heaps here. So write down all the stuff you want to get rid of, all the terrible things which someone's done to you or you've done to them, all the rotten stuff of your past, all the fears of the future. Write them down on toilet paper in brown ink. You've heard this before, the association. And then take it to the toilet and do the letting go ceremony. That's called patinisaga, throwing things away. When it goes down the toilet, let the memory of it go with it. It's shit. You shouldn't be holding that stuff. So that's patinisaga. Muti is called freedom. It's another way of letting go. And how do you manage to do that? What's the difference between being free and being in prison? There's a whole story behind this, but I'm not going to go over that again. Why is it that people up in the jail, up the road, they actually are far more comfortable than you staying here? They get 3 meals a day over there. Much more choice. And they can watch TV. They don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock or whatever and chant at 6 o'clock. At 6 o'clock while you're chanting, they're still in bed up in jail and they murdered people. What crime did you do to have to get up so early? But why is it that people up in jail want to escape and people here? You know, there's a waiting list usually to get on one of these retreats. You know, there's no waiting list. There's no people volunteering to go to prison. Oh, waiting list, and as soon as there's a space, then you can go in. There's a waiting list trying to get out. So what is the difference between freedom and being in prison? The only difference is it's not how comfortable this is or how austere this is. It's whether you want to be here or whether you want to be somewhere else. If you want to be somewhere else, that is called prison, wherever it happens to be. So if you're fed up sitting here, you want to go to bed, this hall is now your prison. Because you don't want to be here, you want to be somewhere else. If you're in an old body, it's getting old and sick, you don't want to be in this body, you want to get a new version in your next life, then this body is the prison for you. If you're in a meditation, you're tired, you're restless, you don't want to be here, then your meditation's a prison. No sense of freedom at all. And how do you let go of those prisons we make in life? You don't need to leave this hall. You don't need to change your partner, to change your body, or change anything except your attitude. To, I want to be here. I want to be here in this old, creaky, fat body. I want to be here with this stupid, tired, restless mind. I want to be in this hall here, which is sometimes too hot and then sometimes too cold. And when we get it just the nice and when it's really hot in here, I just can't believe why people are still wearing blankets. Crazy people. Can't we? Oh, if it's cold, wear a blanket. But this is not cold, it's hot already here. So anyway, I can't understand, but anyway, everyone's different. So, do you want to be here? Do you want to be somewhere else? If you want to be here, you're free. If you want to be somewhere else, you're in prison. So to let go of the prisons of life, change the attitude to, I want to be here, this is good enough. Now that is really important for your meditation. Any problems in meditation is because you want to be somewhere else. You're not happy to be here. You're watching the breath, but you want nimitta. Breath is not good enough for you. You want nimittas. You get nimittas. You don't want nimittas. You've been with nimittas. I want jhanas. All these places, I mean, that's why you don't get anywhere. You always want to be somewhere else. So, want to be here. Whatever here happens to be. Even you're tired and sleepy, half asleep, if you want to be here, then you're free. And the last one, Analia, is where nothing sticks. Actually, Analia's not here today. She's one of the nuns. Analia means nothing sticks to you, like a Teflon mind. So, the past, you just had a jhana, it doesn't stick to you. It's gone, finished. That was a few moments ago. So you don't long for it anymore. It's just gone. You've got a new moment. Someone said, you stupid old cow. And that was a few moments ago. It doesn't stick to you. You let it go immediately. Nothing sticks. The Teflon mind. Or what I prefer these days than the Teflon mind is a simile of the lotus. A lotus, please excuse me for using gross words, but this actually makes you remember it. You get so much information on this retreat that what are you going to remember? Only the stories which stand out. So, a lotus, someone pees on a lotus. All of the urine just falls off and leaves no residue. The lotus smells as fragrant as it did before you peed on it. And next, someone comes along and pours Chanel number 5 over the lotus. And after it all drips off the lotus, you smell the lotus, it still smells of lotus. It doesn't smell of perfume. Because nothing sticks to the lotus. So that is how we let go. When people call us idiots, stupid, they metaphorically pee all over us with their words. And no abuse. Nothing sticks. And then someone pours Chanel number 5 over you. You're the most amazing monk. The greatest meditator. A blessing to the world. We're so lucky to have you as your teacher. And as soon as they said that, you're the same old monk you were before. Ajahn Donut. Fat and sweet and holy in the middle. So you don't keep anything. Praise and blame. Just like urine and perfume off a lotus, nothing sticks. That's Analia. That's letting go. So those are the 4 ways of letting go, in brief. So remember what they are? Giving, See how much you can get rid of. Not how much you can get. Just throwing things away. The third one is just being happy to be here, wherever here happens to be. You're always free. And lastly, like if you are in a prison, sometimes I've said this and I actually mean it. If ever I get, I'm a good monk, I don't do things wrong, but if ever somebody sets me up because they're jealous of something and they get some court case against me and I go to jail, I'll be as happy as ever going to prison. Because in prison you don't have to give talks, you don't have to teach retreats, you don't have to get tired going all over the world teaching, you don't, no one is ever bothering you. And if ever, it's really difficult for me to get a retreat these days. It's just too many invitations, too many stuff going on. But if ever I want a retreat in prison, all I need to do is to punch one prison officer on the nose and I get 3 months solitary. 3 month personal retreat. Food brought to my cell every day. Nobody bothering me at all. Oh, that would be bliss. So if I went to jail, I'd be happy to be there. Honestly. So that's why you're not worried about wherever you happen to be. That's, and the last one is nothing sticks to you. Dear Ajahn, you don't take rebirth. Only karma passes on. When there is no self involved, why should I care about rebirth? I don't get born again. Karma does. Any thoughts? Yeah, if that's what you really think, if that's really who you are, then you don't get reborn. You're an arahant. But if that is just words and it's not really your deep insights and view, as long as there is an idea of a self underneath there somewhere, then there is something for karma to stick on. And then it's not karma gets reborn, you do. You made yourself. So it's very easy to say. But is that what you really mean? So, you know, you find out that when you go see the doctor says, I'm terribly sorry, madam, your cancer is terminal, there's nothing we can do, you're going to die in a few days. How do you react? If you really thought like that, there's no self in here, you go, yes, at last, woohoo! Wouldn't you? Oh, he's, oh no, I'm too young to die. I'm only 70. What would you say? Then Dr. Kesari Dharmananda in Brickfields, his doctor, I saw him and the doctor confirmed this. He said when Dr. Kesari Dharmananda was told that his cancer was terminal, nothing more he can do, he's going to die soon, he burst out laughing. And the doctor was so impressed. This was real. He just found out he's going to die. And he thought it was so funny. If you want to know why, imagine that on this retreat we were so rich that we were going to give a prize. Just a raffle. And the prize was, for one of you lucky meditators, a first class tickets for two. It's Australia, on Qantas. First class on Qantas to Los Angeles for two. Where you will stay on a 6-star hotel, not 5-star, that's passé, 6-star. Where you will have dinner every evening with your favorite Hollywood actors or actresses, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, whoever you like, we'll arrange, you'll have dinner with them every evening, a different one every evening. And $1,000 for you and your friend to spend every day in the United States. All for free. And that was the prize. And at the end of the retreat, I picked the lucky person. It was you. How would you feel? And they go, wow, a perfect holiday. 2 weeks, my favorite place, my favorite people, $1,000 each to spend every day for 2 weeks. Wow. And you ask, when can I go? When can I go? When can I go? And you say, well, maybe 2 weeks' time. So, oh, can't I make it 1 week? I said, okay, 1 week. And in 1 week's time, in 3 days' time, you'd already be packing. 4 days' time, you'd be really excited. Only 3 days to go, only 2 days to go, the night before you wouldn't be able to sleep at night. I'm going to Hollywood tomorrow, meeting all my famous people. You wouldn't sleep that night, you'd be so excited. So, the meaning of this simile is this. What is better? Going up to heaven because you've been good people and kind and generous. Going up to heaven or going to Los Angeles and Hollywood. Which is better? It's obvious. Going to heaven, well, is much better than going to Los Angeles. So, if the doctor said, congratulations, you've won the prize, in 2 weeks you're going to die. You think, 2 weeks, can I make it 1 week, please? And 3 days before you're about to die, you start getting really excited. 2 days, only 2 days to go, the night before you'll be so excited, of, you know, you're going to go to heaven tomorrow, you won't be able to sleep all night. And even just when you die, yes, you'll be so excited, you're going to heaven, woohoo! Why can't people be like that? Oh, I don't want to die. What are you talking about? Okay, if you've been a bad person, you've done lots of bad karma, you've never been generous, you've always been mean and spiteful and nasty, fair enough, you should be very afraid of dying. But you people are really kind and generous. When the doctor says you're going to die, he said, bring it on. 3 weeks to live, can't you make it one, doctor? Now, that's the Buddhist. So that's karma and rebirth. What is the history of the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya and Sri Lanka? The history of the Bodhi tree, I think you many know this. The Bodhi tree was a tree under which the Buddha sat to become enlightened. And the Sanghamitta took a sapling and brought it to Sri Lanka. And later on the tree got destroyed because it was a symbol of Buddhism and people didn't like Buddhism. Sometimes they like it, sometimes they don't. That's part of life. So they tried to destroy the tree, but we got the sapling in Sri Lanka. And from that sapling we have many other trees, like grandchildren of the Mahabodhi tree. This is the one in India. We've got one over in Bodhinyana, but we don't really tell people about it too much. And there's one over in Dharamsala. We have many of these saplings. And the reason we don't tell anybody about it, because the Buddha said, monks, and it includes you, nuns, lay people, do not be heirs of my material things, be heirs to my Dhamma. So we've even got relics of the Buddha in Bodhinyana Monastery. We've got relics of the Buddha here as well. Do you want to see them? Real relics of the Buddha. It's called the suttas. Those are the teachings of the Buddha. He said, be heirs to my teachings, not the material stuff. So what happens? You get relics and people build big stupas over them. But, you know, are they really useful, relics of the Buddha? When you got the teachings, the relics, I'm sorry, but the relics will not make you enlightened. The teachings will. So they're far more powerful. So the Bodhi tree, yeah, it's a nice thing to remember. But, as somebody said, the real Bodhi tree, the thing which will keep you cool and protected, is called right view. Sit under right view, the first factor of the Eightfold Path. And that will always keep you cool, wherever you go. And that means no one can destroy that. So wherever you go in the world, you're always sitting under the Bodhi tree. The real Bodhi tree. So anyway, that's, you know, how we take these things, which sometimes we have, oh, just so many superstitions and so many relics and so many Bodhi trees and so many Buddha statues. And we forget, you know, what it's all supposed to mean, which is the Dhamma. Anyway, I've often heard you say that when we practice, what we mostly do is train our will to be smarter, kinder, etc. Instead, we should let go of the will. Yep. So does that mean we shouldn't try to be nicer and more considerate of others? If you try to be nicer and more considerate of others, it's false, and you end up getting frustrated and angry at people. Should we just not worry too much about what everyone else thinks and just be ourselves, even if that is sometimes a bit rude? No, don't be yourself. Be your non-self. And then you're not rude anymore. Trying to be yourself, you just get into more trouble. That's my answer. Because I've got to move on. As you can experience, we see that the world is moving towards materialism. Buddhist values also changing accordingly, like other practices. Cyberbullying, internet scams are a few examples. Five precepts. What are your thoughts about these? Thank you. I don't really think too much. There's always bullying somewhere. Whenever there is people in authority and people in less authority, there'll always be some people who use that for bullying. That's why, in the Sangha, the way the Buddha set it up, there is no boss. There's no authority, no hierarchy in the Sangha. When we have a meeting, like we did after the Patimokkha yesterday, every monk has a vote. Equal vote. And sometimes I get outvoted. Even I built the place. I've been here longer than anybody. And sometimes some Jojo monk who just comes, he just ordained, he has the same vote as I have. And I like that. Because it means actually this is how the Buddha set it up. So when there is no hierarchy like that, then the person or the thing which runs the monastery is the Sangha, not a monk. And just like some of you sort of, you know, you think you're disciples of mine, but remember what the three refuges are. What's the three refuges? You take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Ajahn Donut? No way. Ajahn Chah? Nope. The Dalai Lama? No. You take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Which includes the nuns as well, their Sangha as well. So that's you take refuge in, not a person, but no, the whole institution of the Sangha. Which means that we don't get the hierarchies, we don't get the bullying. If there is a person who thinks that an abbot, the head monk or the head nun, is supposed to be the boss, you know, when we first started Dhammasara, you know, we called the head nun the abbess, and then that soon became a change to the nickname became the abyss, because she was too controlling. So we don't use the abyss anymore. No, for the head nun, it's going to call it abbot instead of abyss. So it's supposed to be no hierarchies. So internet scams, oh come on, people are just so stupid, some of the internet scams. You won the lottery, just send your bank details and we will transfer 25 million US into your... I mean, you have to be really greedy and just really stupid to fall for those internet scams. So it's just because people have got too much wanting and craving that just their desires overcome their wisdom. And the five precepts are brilliant, they are timeless. So more people keep five precepts, the better the world will be. So sometimes I thought that if I ever become the President of the United States, I'll scrap all the laws and just have five precepts. I'll scrap all taxes and we'll just have donation boxes on every corner of every street. So the military will run by donations only. It wouldn't have much military. Anyway, what are the four Satipatthanas and their meaning, please? Oh, that's a whole talk. Shall I do that tomorrow? Satipatthanas. Okay, Satipatthanas tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, I seem to be having trouble letting go of control. I've heard you talk about it a lot, but I can't seem to do it. You don't do it. If you do letting go, that's not letting go, that's more doing. So just, could the same thing be stopping me from falling asleep too? Absolutely. So look, this is when you leave here, if you want to have a good night's sleep, it's so obvious what you should do. Go into your room, lay down and meditate. And then you'll fall asleep straight away. Because that's what you do here. And if you want to stay awake in the morning when you're meditating, come in here, sit down and try to fall asleep. And then you'll be clear and mindful all morning before breakfast. It's true, isn't it? So, So it is. Try and be a passenger, not a journey. Try and use these visualizations, these images. Now, when you're sitting down, sit down and just be a passenger and just see what happens. Passenger on an aircraft. On an aircraft, you can't, you know, order the pilot what to do. You actually can't do anything. Even the way you treat the flight attendants, you have to be careful. Just like this story of this, actually I read this on In-Flight Magazine. I actually don't just sit there doing nothing, sometimes I read. And there was a man who's sitting not in the aisle seat, but just in the middle seat. On the aisle seat, there was a parrot. And when the flight attendant came past to ask what they wanted to drink, the parrot shouted at the flight attendant, "Give me a whiskey, you pig." And the guy said, "Oh, can I have a cup of tea, please?" And the poor flight attendant was so just, you know, discomforted with that, that she came back a few minutes later with a whiskey for the parrot and forgot the cup of tea for the gentleman. So the gentleman said, "No, my cup of tea, please." And by this time, the parrot had swigged the whiskey down and said, "Give me another one, you cow." And getting that from a passenger, she was so sort of surprised. She went back into the galley and brought another whiskey back. And again, you know, the guy hadn't got his cup of tea. So, cup of tea, please. Just a cup of tea, that's all. At which time, the parrot said again, "Give me another whiskey, you horse." And so at that, the guy realized, you don't get a cup of tea by just being polite. So he decided also to be impolite to the flight attendant and said, "And don't forget my tea, you bitch." Really unpleasant. And the flight attendant, you know, the lady, came back with a couple of big male flight attendants. And you know, she complained, said, "You can't talk like that on this aircraft." And took the both of them, unbuckled their seat belts, lifted them up, opened the emergency door, threw them out of the plane at 32,000 feet. And as they were falling down, the parrot turned to the guy and said, "You've got a very bad attitude for someone who can't fly." So that was an old joke. Where was that come from? So anyway, don't have a bad mouth when you're meditating. Come on, mind, watch the breath. Come on, you can do this, you bitch of a brain of mind. So just be kind and be like, imagine you're a passenger. You can't talk like that to anybody. It's not to your mind. So you're just sitting there and just seeing what happens. Looking out the window, looking at the clouds, maybe looking at the scenery down below. You can't tell the plane which way to go. So you, or if you want to, just imagine you're driving the car. But actually you're not really driving the car, it's one of the Google cars. Automatic, driverless. Imagine those driverless cars. That would be an amazing thing to sit in to actually to understand what meditation's all about. You just program the destination, you know, Nibbana, Nibbana. Press that in there and just let the car take you there. It's easy, that's what meditation is. If there is time, could you please tell the story of Ajahn Chah doing an exorcism on a lady by trying to boil her with lots of sound effects, please? Maybe, if we've got time at the end, because you know, that's a long story. It's in the book, Open the Door of Your Heart. "I am confused by the eighth precept, not to sleep on a high and luxurious bed. I'm very happy with the beds provided here, so this is not a complaint, but rather I question the relevance of that precept. Certainly compared to many parts of the world or even the Buddha's time, these beds are high and luxurious, so maybe it's not really relevant anymore to a situation like this retreat center." Exactly. It means like over-luxurious, as a like a conceit, like a four-poster bed. Like a queen, is it queen bed or an emperor bed? Do they have emperor beds? Bigger than a queen, bigger than a king bed. Huge. Just as a sign of conceit. Look who I am. So that's really all this is using luxurious. These beds aren't luxurious. And a bird bought them from a cheap shop. but they're comfortable. You know, and that's the whole point of them. Being comfortable, nice mattress, so you can have a good night's sleep. So these do not qualify as high and luxurious in the context of Australia. These are ordinary beds, and they're there for your comfort. If you talk about high beds, especially high seats, you can't get a higher seat than on an aircraft at 32,000 feet. That's a high seat, 32,000 feet above the ground. So you shouldn't be able to fly an aircraft if you... Is that high seats? Pretty high, isn't it? It's 32,000 feet high. It's not what it means. It means anything luxurious. So this is not really overly luxurious. So you can sleep on them. No problem at all. Don't worry about that. It's hard enough to sleep anyway, according to what you tell me. I hear you monks keep a lot of rules. Why is that? For what purpose? For fun. It is fun keeping rules. As per suttas, what has the Buddha said about the origin and the ending of the universe world? If so, they're compatible with modern thinking. Okay, origins and ends of the world. This is one of my favourite modern teachings. And if you haven't heard it before, this is actually interesting stuff because this takes science to another level, Buddhism and science coming together. About 500, 600 years ago, people in all the different countries of the world thought the planet Earth was flat. Always thought it was a flat Earth. And if you went into the most modern form of transport in those days, boats, ships, if you sailed far enough, you'd fall off the edge. So people were really terrified of going too far away in their ships because their concept was a flat Earth. And it actually, people like, who was the first guy who, Magellan? Or, yeah, whatever it is, anyway. The first ones who circumambulated the globe. Apparently, all the sailors under this captain were terrified they'd fall off the edge, because they all thought the Earth was flat. And a few scientists realized it wasn't flat, it was round. But people thought that way, flat Earth. And of course, you are all more so sophisticated, none of you believe that. You all know the world is round, go in any direction, from Jhana Grove, go any direction, and all the roads lead back to Jhana Grove. From here, whatever direction you go to, you always come back here. That's how important Jhana Grove is. And when I was a young man interested in science, I started to wonder, what about space? The universe. Has the universe got an end to it? A limit? Or is the universe infinite or finite? And there is a very simple mathematical proof. The universe can't be infinite. Cannot be. It's a brilliant proof. So simple, but just so convincing. So if the universe is not finite, and this is truth, all the scientists realize this universe has got a finite volume. There's only a certain number of stars. They don't go on forever. So, what happens when you come to the end of the universe? Is there a wall, a big brick wall, so you cannot go any further? Or is it razor wire? Or is it just a big chasm at the end of the universe? What is at the end of the universe? And I sometimes thought about that and I could never come up with a good answer. If there's a wall, there has to be something on the other side of the wall. If there's a fence, you can see on the other side of the fence. Even if there's a chasm, there has to be something on the other side of the chasm. I mean, nothing ever made sense. Until when I went to university, simple general relativity, just like planet Earth is not flat, the universe is also curved. In whatever way you go, not just around the planet, whatever way you go, this way, that way in the universe, again, you'll always come back to Jhana Grove. Every place in the universe is the center of the universe. Because the universe is curved. You keep going, you never come to an end because you keep going round and round and round. Samsara. That is the nature of this universe. It's a curved universe, it has no edges. Every physicist knows that. Now, we come to the next level, which answers your question. Time. We always used to think that time, like the earth, was flat. You go back far enough and you fall off the edge. The beginning of time. You go far in the other direction, you know, in the TARDIS, Doctor Who's time machine or whatever. You go far enough into the future and you come to the end of time. Armageddon. We always think that time, being flat, has to have a beginning or an end. Like the planet Earth or like the universe. Why? Because that never makes any sense. If there was a God, then who created the God? What was before the beginning? What's after the end? It never makes any sense philosophically, logically. And the reason is because time is not flat. Time is also curved. It doesn't need a beginning or an end. No more than the universe, no more than planet Earth. And a time will come when people generations from now will look back upon this time and they will laugh at the people who thought that time was flat. Just like we now laugh at people who thought the earth was flat. Limited duration, but no beginning, no end. Curved time. Da da da. Now you know the meaning of life. I like that. Circles are cool. Straight lines don't really make any sense. So there we go. That is beginnings and ends. And even I was mentioning Stephen Hawking the other day, because when I saw that film, the Theory of Everything, because you know, I know a lot of the people involved, and that was what Stephen Hawking said. He now understands a universe without any boundaries in space or time. No beginnings, no ends. The Big Bang didn't start the universe. It was just one of the events. There was life before the Big Bang, as well as afterwards. A universe without boundaries. That is cool. Anyway, there we go. You say it's not about the world, it's my being on this retreat, a predestined act. Yes, so was his question. You didn't have any choice but to answer it. Ask it. Oh, holy roundness, how can you develop compassion for those when you know they are exploiting you? You are exploiting me. You always exploit me. But that's what I'm there here for. So I have compassion even though I know you're exploiting me to the max. Even if you give donations, it doesn't go to me. It usually goes to nuns and monasteries. I don't get anything out of this. Or it goes to some other good cause. What do I ever get out of this? Just tiredness and headaches. Same old questions. Not laughing at my jokes. Oh, jeez. So you exploited me to the max, but that is the meaning of my life. To be exploited. So please exploit me. That's how you develop compassion. When actually you're not really exploiting because there's no one here to exploit. So when you have a sense of me and a sense of self, when you have wants, desires, needs, then you get frustrated. But you don't have any needs. Got to be somewhere, might as well be here. So, okay, so I'm here. So being exploited. So of course, you know, I'm compassionate towards you. Hi Ajahn. Just as a trial, just to see if it is effective, please could we have no jokes for tomorrow morning session only? No jokes, okay. For tomorrow morning's morning session, there'll be no jokes. From the time we come up here until our breakfast, there'll be no jokes. But for the talk, there has to be jokes. Apologies, this is to throw everything possible to see if we can get better meditation. We will feedback in the afternoon. Jokes in the night is fine. We go to bed anyway. Hope this is not being rude. Look, it's being a control freak. I can't stop jokes. If you don't want jokes, you shouldn't come on this retreat. You know what it's like. I can't stop myself. It's just, it's nothing to do with me. It's not my will, okay? It's just brainwashing. Does the loving kindness meditation with its wide scope of thinking about all kinds of being lead to stillness? Yes, it does. There, here's another. Sometimes these are jokes, but they also have a very deep meaning. That's why I like telling these stories. Is loving kindness meditation. Sometimes I teach loving kindness meditation. And then sometimes people say, well, we can't do it. So if they can't do loving kindness meditation, I begin teaching them metta meditation. And if they find difficulty with metta meditation, I teach them breath meditation. And if they come and say, well, breath meditation is not really working, then I teach them anapanasati. And if they can't do anapanasati, then I teach them letting go meditation. And if they can't do letting go meditation, I teach them insight meditation. If they can't do insight meditation, then I teach them vipassana. And if they can't do vipassana, then I teach them loving kindness meditation. Even though that's what I taught them at the beginning, by now they've totally forgotten. And the reason I do this is only a trick, because they're all the same. They may have a different name, a different flavour, but it's all the same type of rice and curry. So it's just all the same. So it's all of these things lead to stillness, if it's the right type of meditation. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if a serial killer or a mass murderer came on a retreat, hang on, who wrote this? Any serial killers on this retreat? Please lock your doors tonight. There's a serial killer on this retreat. Of course, there's no serial killers on this retreat. Would they still get jhana if they followed the instructions? Yeah. Anguli Mara, he was a serial killer. He got sort of jhanas. Or would their karma stop them from entering peaceful states? Their karma would make it more difficult. But you know, with Anguli Mara, serial killer, you know the story there, that he was being chased, he was actually chasing the Buddha, trying to kill him. And no matter how fast Anguli Mara ran, and the Buddha actually just kept on outpacing him. Imagine if the Buddha was alive today, he would be able to get the goal, he would be able to beat Usain Bolt. If Anguli Mara can't catch the Buddha, Usain Bolt never will be able to catch him. So Usain Bolt thinks he's the fastest man on the planet. Absolutely not. So anyway, what did the Anguli Mara said? He said, stop, monk, stop. And the Buddha said, I have stopped. You stop. And Anguli Mara stopped. Not just running. Not just stop killing people. Stopped his mind. Came very, very still and peaceful. That's why I always remember that. That is a beautiful story of how to get jhanas, how to meditate. Stop. Stop doing things. Stop going places. Stop trying to achieve. Stop trying to get rid of things. Stop. Okay? Don't start again, okay? Stop. That is one word which gets you into jhanas, if you allow it to actually to stay with you. Which is why, even in Australia, there's so much Dharma around. Whenever I'm in a car, I'm usually sitting in the front seat, I see all the Dharma, every crossroads, stop sign. That's the Dharma, that's the Buddha teaching you. Stop. Anyway, got some more. Oh, not that many to go, good. Every village you go to in India, Thailand, Cambodia, just about, has a revered Bodhi tree. All claim it like prophecy, claim it's a progeny of the Buddha's Bodhi tree. Is this usually true, or is it a bit of like the splinters of the true cross story? Is there a Buddhist tradition folklore here? Please enlighten. Is it really important whether it's a real Bodhi tree or not? Are we just worshipping just the, what I call the containers of Buddhism, instead of what that Bodhi tree is supposed to be signifying? It'd be wonderful if the great Bodhi tree in Anuradhapura, more people actually meditate under it. I went there once, and because I was well known, they let me go inside the enclosure and actually meditate. I was the only one meditating there. Everyone was praying and chanting and messing around and taking photographs. It wasn't that peaceful. How many people actually meditate under the Bodhi tree? And how many people go there and ask for favours? Is that what the Bodhi tree is there for? So sometimes we're missing the point of a Bodhi tree. Bodhi tree is there not to be worshipped, but to be sat under. So we don't worship, just notice the things the Buddha said, don't worship these things, be an heir to my Dhamma, not material things. And then actually Buddhism becomes revitalized again. Instead of just being all these ceremonies, all this, you know, memories of the Buddha, but not actually understanding their meaning. The tree is to be sat under, not just to be bowed to. Here we go. If someone close to me is terribly ill, but is too scared of death, what can I do to make it any better? Do opiate drugs cloud one's consciousness? What can one do to improve their rebirth? I or the person themselves. So someone is scared to death of death. Well, it's a bit late now. They should have got their act together while they were still conscious. So why are you scared of death? It's only because it's the unknown. So one of the greatest ways is get in some deep meditation on this retreat and ask yourself the simple question, what is my earliest memory? And see if you can remember when you were very young. See if you can remember when you were in your mother's womb. See if you can remember your previous life. Then you know you've died before. Here we go again. This time, make sure you get it right and don't mess up the exam. You know what happens if you don't pass the exam, you have to take it again? That's why you got reborn again. Me too, I must have messed up the last exam, but determined I'm not going to fail next time. Otherwise you have to come back again. So, if you are terminally ill, actually, as they say, we are all terminally ill. The meaning of life, you know what the meaning of life is? Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Beautiful sort of simile. Isn't that true? It's a sexually transmitted terminal disease. That's you. In a nutshell. They're all terminal. Just some are more terminal than others. So, why are you scared about that? It's only because we don't know what's going to happen. Look, if you were a Christian, fair enough, be really, really scared. And I don't mean this to put down other religions, but in Christianity, many of those other theistic religions, only one life, only one go at the exam. And the consequences are eternal. Eternal happiness or eternal torture. That's the stakes at the final exam, what people understand if you're a Christian or a Muslim or something. Now, if you get afraid at a driving test or afraid at doing some sort of test at work or when you're at school, you can always redo that. And it's not so eternal punishment or eternal happiness. Imagine that you really believe in that stuff. You're about to die, and this is really big time test. If you fail, there's something wrong with you. That's it. Guantanamo Bay is like a holiday camp. It's like Jhana Grove compared to what's going to happen to you. So those people who believe that, and really believe that, they must be really terrified at death, as you would at the biggest exam of existence. And if you mess it up, you're in big trouble. And who's been that pure? That good, you're not scared. That's why it's a very, very cruel time for people who really believe in that. But as a Buddhist, you're fine. If you fail, you always can take it again. So it's much better when you believe in reincarnation. It's a much nicer thing. I mean, always people have a second chance in life. You know, if you don't get it right this time with your partner, you can get divorced and remarry. You know, you don't have to get it right first. How many people do get it right first time? I remember this person told me that she was, since we're on her ninth marriage. And I didn't know her, but in fact, one of her tomatoes friends, school friends. So why? Why you've got married? She was about to get married the ninth time. She was inviting him to the ceremony. Why are you getting married nine times? And she was very honest. And actually what she said made a lot of sense. Well, you know, I like the dating. know, I like the sort of the excitement and the romance and the engagement. That's just a beautiful part. And just the planning of the wedding and the wedding itself. That's beautiful. It's what happens next I don't like. So after the wedding, we know, get divorced and start again. And there's something to that because, you know, you see any sort of romance novel or sort of, you know, movie, you get to the wedding, they get married and have a happy time, and that's when the movie stops. Because what happens next is a problem. So this lady, you know, she understood. She was actually quite wise. I quite respect her. Start all over again. And the nice part. Okay, I might maybe mark. I don't really know what I'm talking about, but anyway, there we go. So if someone is scared to death, and it's because, number one, maybe they've got a bad worldview of stuff. No compassion. You get compassion, you don't get scared of death. No, look, honestly, if there was a God and you had to get judged, you know, oh, this is what I thought a long time ago. Imagine like an Adolf Hitler, you know, going to get judged or something. If these are heavenly beings judging you, they'd always be kind and compassionate and forgiving. Even I can forgive you all the stuff people do. Imagine a heavenly being, much higher than, ah, never mind, Amanda, what you did. You know, it's okay. And if even Adolf Hitler, just out of so much compassion, he would say, look, there's a lot of people who just don't understand. And they can't forgive you. So what we'll do, we'll just shave off that silly moustache. We'll give you a different hairstyle. We'll give you a different name, and you can still go up to heaven, okay? But don't tell anybody who you are. Just out of compassion, because, you know, if my father could tell me, son, the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you've ever done. Surely a heavenly being can do something like that. Doesn't matter what you've ever done in your life. The door to heaven, the door to my heart will always be open to you. Now that is Dharma, that is compassion. That is like high-mindedness. Punishment never ever made any sense to me. How anyone, especially the heavenly being, could inflict pain on another makes no sense. So if you understand that, you don't have any fear of death. Now, fear of dying, yes, because dying can be very unpleasant. But when you get to the death point, that's always sweet. You know, you fear of your body, no pain anymore. And if you have got opiates in your system, the last few moments are always clear. Because what happens is your mind separates from your brain. The opiates affect your brain and make you dull. But once the mind separates, you're clear, pain-free. And even people with dementia, they can remember. You know, their loved ones sitting about, where have you been, Ananda? I've been here weeks and weeks. But, you know, you were had dementia, your brain was demented. But the last few moments, your mind clears. So many stories of that. So, that is opiate. You can take the opiates. Because what happens is, when the death actually happens, you are clear, and then everything you've done in your life, your whole character, that will come up. If you've been a good person, then you have good memories. If you've been a wise person, only your bad memories you can let go of. That's what we're doing here, we're letting go of the past, for goodness sake. So let it go now, so when you're dead, you can't even remember it. If there's a time, could you tell the story of Ajahn Chah doing exorcism on a lady by trying to bore her? Do you want to say we do this one? You asked for it, here we go. So, there, Ajahn Chah, his amazing wisdom. Okay, he was a great psychologist, so wise, so innovative, and that made him so much fun to be around. How he dealt with very, very difficult situations in a totally unique way. In this particular time, the lay people, headmen of the village, came early in the morning to announce to Ajahn Chah that one of the women in the village had been possessed by a spirit and was crazy. They'd been up all night trying to deal with this. She was violent, she was crazy. And, of course, what they did in those days, they couldn't actually have them committed to a hospital. They took them to the monks. because the monks actually were good at doing exorcisms. And a related story, there was one monk in the north of Thailand who was actually making his basically reputation by being a great exorcist. So they would also bring sort of people to them who were possessed. Now some were just, you know, psychotic. And, you know, he would do some exorcism on them, and he became quite well known. But he gave it up after the following experience. And all you men here, you would actually feel this much more than the women. Because what had happened, she was put in front of him, he was sitting down, like I'm sitting down, on the floor, and he was doing the chanting for her, and she was absolutely crazy. And when people are that mad, they've got enormous power. And really sharp. He was doing the chanting to try and get rid of holy water, trying to sprinkle that on her. And as quick as a flash, she reached under his robe and got his scrotum, his testicles, and would not let them go. And that poor monk suffered so much because, you know, enormous power, nails, and that poor monk was really badly injured. It took him a long time to walk properly after that, and he never did another exorcism ever again. The memory was just too traumatic, because they're very fast. So that's, monks should not be doing that anyway, so that, no, when I heard that, no way am I going to do any exorcisms. So be careful, babe, because you probably have dreams of that tonight, sorry. But anyway, Ajahn Chah was much better than that. So they said they were bringing this woman into his presence, and you could actually hear her screaming, you know, from the front of, you know how big Wat Pa Pong is, you know, where Ajahn Chah's hut was. You could hear her screaming when they bring her into the monastery. And when they actually brought her close, and her big eyes, foaming at the mouth, screaming her head off, profanities, the sort of things which, you know, a Buddhist would never do that in a monastery, anywhere. And three or four, you know, big heavy farmers, you know, having a hard time holding her. And as soon as Ajahn Chah saw this crazy lady, really violent, big eyes, foaming and everything, he told the novices, "I need a hole dug pretty quick, now! And I need water poured, a lot of it, a lot of water, quick, now!" And these poor novices were running all over the place, because Ajahn Chah didn't really usually bark at people like that, but he needed water quickly. And all of us watching, you know, this is, you don't have TVs or movies, this was much better. You know, this is real. He never knew where this was going to go, what he was going to do. So it was fascinating to be with Ajahn Chah when he was up to these tricks. And he was, by the by, one of his other tricks, I'll get back to the exorcism soon. There was a major general in the Thai army came to see Ajahn Chah for a blessing. Now, Ajahn Chah doesn't usually do much blessings, but this was a major general. And, you know, even now, the generals are in power in Thailand. They've always had a lot of power in Thailand. So you don't mess around with a general, not even if you're Ajahn Chah. So we were, Mai is out there watching what he's doing. The general wanted a blessing, you know, with holy water. And Ajahn Chah didn't have any holy water. So I wonder what he's going to do. And so Ajahn Chah, come here. Just bend over, bend down. And so the general bent over with his head like this. And Ajahn Chah, spat all over his head. And as soon as he did that, I thought, Ajahn Chah, you've pushed your luck too far this time. That's a general. And then, to our horror, Ajahn Chah got his hand and rubbed it in. Rubbed his spit in the general's hair. Oh God, this is going to be awful. And that general, he utters, "Sadhu, sadhu, I'm so lucky. You can't get better holy water than this straight from Ajahn Chah's mouth. Thank you, that's so lucky." Fortunately, the generals are stupid. Otherwise, he'd have been killed on the spot. There's always good funding around Ajahn Chah. He never knew what he's going to do next. You know, I can't go that far. I go far enough telling stupid jokes, but not that far. Anyway, the exorcist, crazy, waving her arms, "More water, boil, really hot, bigger hole." And, you know, what does he need a hole for? Boiling water. You know, usually do the chanting or like the holy water or something. No, I need it now, quick. Big hole, water. And she was really crazy. She didn't know what was going on, and no one else knew what was going on. This was just really madness. And then Ajahn Chah finally let on what he was up to. He said, this is a really dangerous spirit in this woman. Really powerful, very bad. The only way we can deal with this, we have to put it in the hole. Pour boiling water all over it and bury it. That's the only way we can deal with this. So I need a bigger hole, more boiling water. We've got to put her in the hole and pour all the boiling water over her. Now, even I, being with Ajahn Chah that long, thought he might actually do that. He was so unpredictable, he didn't know what he was going to do next. Really, I thought it was possible. He'd bung this woman in the hole and pour all this boiling water over her. And then bury her. He could do that. You spit on the general, you can just do anything. The point was that she also believed Ajahn Chah would do this. And as soon as she heard that if she didn't get her act together quick, she'd have boiling water poured all over her and buried in a hole alive. That self-preservation kicked in so quickly, within a few, maybe 20, 30 seconds, she stopped screaming. She was sitting quietly. And then that's when Ajahn Chah sort of gave her a bit quick teaching, gave her the five precepts, and then, exhausted, she was helped back to the village. That was how he got rid of that demon. Whether it's a real demon or not, or whether it's psychosis, either way, either the demon thought, I better get out quick, otherwise I'm going to get boiled with water, or whether it was the self-preservation overcame the psychosis, I better get quick, better quick, otherwise terrible things are going to happen to me. And she was walked away, problem solved. And that was just such emotional intelligence before I ever knew what that word meant. So innovative. But I can't try that. If you have anyone who's crazy, no way am I going to dig a hole. I get put in jail for doing things like that if it doesn't work. But that's what Ajahn Chah could do, because so innovative, so on the ball, and use something called, you know, self-preservation to actually to calm that woman down. Absolutely brilliant. So that was a story of the crazy woman who had a psychosis. So I think that's enough. Satipatthana tomorrow. It's very hard to have jokes about Satipatthana, but I think I have a couple. Sadhu! 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 Very good. Okay, have a beautiful night. And we'll see what happens afterwards. Well, thank you for the stick.